While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relation, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia, make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
And welcoming you, dear listeners, specifically here on this session of the On The Radar, and where we find ourselves on this Tuesday afternoon. And I know that a lot of you probably have decided, you know what, the Christmas celebrations and the holiday situation is so close. Why not just go and dip my feet into the particular swimming pool very close? Or that might be close, or I am assuming that you're close to a swimming pool. Please ensure that you are safe wherever you go and whichever particular swimming pool situation that you end up in. Because we'd like to see you back in the new year. I hope well rested, and I hope, you know, in terms of having recharged your batteries for the new coming year in its own rights. But where we find ourselves here specifically on your number one talk radio station is that we're obviously here on the radar, where we get into that insightful discussions as we always do every afternoon from 1 to 2.30, and primarily getting you informed on some of the developments that obviously spring up during the course of these last few embers. I would call them embers, sort of like a fire that is dying out towards the end of the year, primarily as developments are still coming thick and fast as they are happening. Now, if you are not specifically, because we don't have the e-paper from today heading into the Christmas period or holiday period active, there is still the e-paper website, the Villager website itself. There are still interesting articles that we still provide and post on that particular platform. You can visit there. Remember that you would need to log in and sign up for a particular sort of like account. It's all completely free, guys. There's no payment function right there. And that the obvious aspect is that you can enjoy some of the interesting reading that we always provide on that notion. Stay up to date with the various social media platforms that we obviously have under the Eagle FM name, as well as also under the Villager name as well. That should give you the updates happening as they are coming through thick and fast across this particular next two and a half weeks. Of December that is still left. On that particular note, dear listeners, we turn to, as we always do, our particular menu lined up for today, specifically citing an introduction to the Namibia Convention Bureau, which is aimed at sort of like strengthening Namibia's position on the aspects of meetings, incentives, exhibitions and conferences. And then we also get into an industry in-depth discussion from the security sector, the security guard sector, and then finally we round that out with a conversation between myself and Eagle FM's, the Villagers, Inomenwa Erastus, in terms of an interesting conversation coming through in the last edition of yesterday's The Villager e-paper platform. On that note, dear listeners, stay tuned for the rest of the programming. We're quickly taking a short break and coming back right after this.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Now, coming back, dear listeners, from that quick break right there, we get into our discussion for today's session of the On The Radar, and specifically starting off with our first item for today's session. This is the Namibia Investment Promotion Board launching the Namibia Convention Bureau earlier today in Windhoek. Now, the NCB is aimed at being a central role player in the coordination of meetings, incentives, conferences and exhibitions, events and specifically developments that will be planned in the country. The launch also saw the unveiling of its website that the NCB will connect to the world, and specifically citing and recording some of the particular developments in terms of how business tourism plays a particular part in Namibia's overall tourism sector. Now, the NIPDB's Nangula Wanja noted that the NCB is aimed at strengthening the meetings, incentives, conferences and exhibitions subsector in the tourism sector of Namibia, and the NCB will be playing a part in ensuring that the tourism sector in the country specifically will be emboldened and actually strengthened through its introduction. Now, Wanja noted that Namibia is a strong competitor as a destination in leisure tourism overall, and that the rebound of the sector has been long since the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as also had been striving to achieve its 2019 levels. We have a listen to what Wanja said in that specific notion.
A few years, and it's exciting to see the launch of this project that started a few years ago. As you can see, we have got the Honorable former Minister here in our presence, and it is because, I don't remember the exact year, Honorable Minister, but you launched the tourism revival strategy. Especially after COVID, we know that tourism is one of the industries that was very, very hard hit by COVID. And there was a revival strategy on tourism. Of course, Namibia is a country that has always focused on what we call leisure tourism, and it's a sector in which we have performed exceedingly well when you compare to our peers in Africa and sometimes even beyond. I think the Honorable Minister recently launched the 2024 report, and it indicated the numbers, and we have seen that since COVID, where I think in about 2020 or 2021, the numbers of visitors to Namibia were below 100,000. But we have recovered and we have gone beyond a million of incoming visitors. Like I said, we have as a country usually focused on leisure tourism, but tourism is an extensive sector and there's quite a number of subsectors. And one of those subsectors is the MICE or business tourism. Now you will kind of ask the question, why does NIPDB have an interest in business tourism? So looking at the tourism revival strategy, MICE tourism was one of the subsectors of the tourism industry that were indicated. And for us, the interest is there. We have been entrusted by the government to promote Namibia as a preferred investment destination. Now, promoting, marketing, and making sure that we brand and profile Namibia involves a lot of activities, some of which are carried locally, others internationally, but you really need to find as many platforms as necessary. And we believe that NCB is one of those platforms, and that is why then we partnered with the Ministry of the Ministry of Environment, Tourism, and Forestry to make sure that we kick off this industry. I will show you probably in one or two slides why that industry is important. But of course, I've got colleagues who will tell us later more about the technical aspects. We know I'm just an auditor, and this one, everything is specialized, so the tourist expert will come and talk to us. So, how did this start? So, we said that in 2022, that is when the revival strategy was put in place. In 2023, Cabinet made a decision that we need to have a Namibia Convention Bureau, and therefore then we started then said, okay, in the interim, NIPDB can support the development and establishment of the sector to the extent that once it is grown, it can either become a standalone agency or it can be absorbed into another agency such as the Namibia Tourism Board or under the ministry. The ministry will determine how to go or where to proceed with that, but that is where we are today. And we are excited that today we are launching this officially, especially for us to start marketing Namibia as a MICE destination. So, why is this sector important? It's important for various reasons. Number one, economic diversification. We said that yes, Namibia as a country, we know that the mining sector contributes to the GDP. We have got the agricultural sector that contributes to the GDP, but we also have tourism. And one of the things that we've done since about 2020 is about how do we diversify the Namibian economy? And one of those ones is the diversification further of the tourism industry. And therefore, that diversification contributes to resilience and economic development. It will help us to attract investment. Investment is about narratives. It's about sentiment. It's about communication. It's about branding. We host events in Namibia, we can attract more visitors to Namibia. And especially when there are business events, people that come to Namibia and attend the event, they will eventually make a decision to invest in Namibia. An example is last year, we hosted an event called the Africa Hospitality Investment Forum. And most of the hotel chains, the Marriott, Holiday Inn and others, came and visited Namibia as part of that event. And we are seeing now they've got an interest of investing in Namibia. I think we have seen that some of them are looking at how they can bring their brands to Namibia. So that is why this particular subsector of tourism was critical to the energy movement. Job creation, and it creates jobs, especially among our lower level skilled or unskilled employees. So whether it is photographers, whether it is actually MSMEs whose product we buy, whether it is printers, we can see that when we bring events, you can see many of these people that are registering, that are supporting the event, we can have many, many jobs that are created in this sector. And then, yes, we can knowledge knowledge exchange and innovation. That is what happens when we are having events. For example, when about a month or so ago, in October, we hosted what they call the Africa PPP Summit that focused on infrastructure, and then, yes, destination. So that is some of the information about the potential of this sector globally. You can see there about 2.1 trillion is applied market research indicated that that is the industry, and it is growing at a cumulative annual growth rate of about 15 or so percent. It's not every sector that is growing at that level globally. So we need to have a little bit of a cake, of our share of that cake. And that focus is going into 2031, and then you can see, of course, the types of business tourism, and then countries that are playing a significant role. So globally, the share, you can see there, I think Europe takes the largest share of the MICE industry. The others like the US or the North America and South America have got a share. Asia has got a bigger share. And Africa, we are at 3%, not very much different from Oceanic. But if you look at the size of our continent, definitely there is more that we can get there. So from an Africa perspective, you can see South Africa, Morocco, Rwanda, Kenya, and Egypt at the top five. Namibia is currently at number 13, but of course that happens based on the information that we share. I'm sure that there's quite a number of other events that are happening in Namibia that are not included in that data. And also just sharing that one is already a promotion in and of itself. When you are included in this publication, the people that host events, they see you. And next time they say, okay, there are events. Namibia is one of the upcoming destinations, and we need to diversify the places where we host our events, and therefore that is something that can happen. So in numbers, I talked about the Africa Hospitality Investment Forum that we hosted here, the Global Africa Hydrogen Summit last year and this year. Recently, we had the PPP Summit. So that is just to give an indication of what the impact of one event. Last year, we also hosted the AU SME Forum. We know that there is the Namibia International Energy Conference that is being hosted. Many, many events that are hosted. I think last year also another event was the Africa Insurance event that was hosted that is bringing more than 1,500 attendants to Namibia. That is food, that is visitors who will then spend money. And what we want also to do as part of that event is when people come, you want to promote Namibia as a leisure tourist destination so that when people visit Namibia, they say, I've never been to this country. I will definitely bring my family. Or as I'm here, I will come with my family. I will spend 3 more days, 1 more week before or after the event. So I think I have probably said much already, so let's just look at it. So that is some of the things that we do, and Esther will talk to you about the MICE visa that we have introduced and some of the events that we have hosted again this year. Bank of Namibia brought the AFI Global Policy Forum there, the Commonwealth Business Summit that was brought by the Ministry Responsible for Trade, Global Africa talked about Namibia Oil and Gas Infrastructure Finance, the Chamber of Mines had the Mining Expo, International Cybersecurity, CSIRO. So that is some of the events that were supported in the past year, the year that is ending now, by the Namibia Convention Bureau to just help also the ease of receiving our visitors, especially through the what we call the MICE visa that Esther will explain to a bit later. So
now, still staying on that particular conversation itself, the Minister of Environment, that being Indeleni Daniel, noted that the MICE industry can be one of those sectors that can help, specifically in the job creation endeavors of the country, with its particular ability to attract so much interest to Namibia. Now, also emphasizing that government is actually dedicated to streamlining these processes and ensuring that conducive environments are positioned by the state in order for these goals to be met, as I mentioned in the first particular notion. Let's have a listen what she mentioned.
As we close also the year 2025 with a milestone, I consider this a milestone for the country, the launch of the Namibian Convention Bureau. This is more than unveiling an institution. It is the start of a new era for Namibia's tourism and economic development. The Bureau represents deliberate policy choices you have all witnessed here to rebuild also after COVID-19, diversify our tourism offering, and position Namibia as a competitive player in the global meeting, incentive, conferences, and exhibition, what we call MICE industry. Our tourism sector recovery plan laid groundwork. The National Special Tourism Master Plan elevated business events to a national priority. This will probably also be launched very, very soon. A lot of work has been done and is now on the final stage. We have seen how countries like Rwanda, South Africa, transformed their economy by investing in MICE infrastructure. Namibia is ready to follow suit. In just 2 years, Namibia has hosted 36 international conferences, from the African Union to the Global Africa Hydrogen Summit. These events inject millions into our economy, supported jobs, and showcased our capability. What was missing was a coordinated national mechanism that we didn't have. Today, with the Convention Bureau, that gap is to be now filled. This aligns with His Excellency the President's call for 500,000 jobs. The MICE industry is one of the fastest growing sectors worldwide, with power to generate employment across hospitality, logistics, transport, catering, technology, MSMEs, and professional services, you name it all. Government has shown its commitment to modernizing legislation, streamlining processes, and even introducing the MICE visa to ease delegate entry. I think, and we continue to to streamline our processes so that it becomes easy for people that matter to our country. But success depends on partnership. We invite investors, venue owners, hotels, developers, and service providers, and all entrepreneurs to join us in building a world-class Namibian MICE experience. This is not one-man show. It requires everybody to join in. You have heard that the success depends on various factors. And I'm sure as we're sitting here, we all know how to come in and be part of this MICE that we have to launch today. Namibia needs a state-of-the-art conference centers, expanded accommodation capacities, modern technology infrastructures, and creative sector services and professional event organizers. Talking about professional event organizers. Ladies and gentlemen, today's launch in Namibia's bold is in Namibia is a bold statement. We are ready to compete globally in the business events market. Let us collaborate, government, private sector, and partners to grow this industry, empower MSME, and contribute to national economy diversification. I think I will need now your wait your mouth, always.
Now, as you heard there, dear listeners, some of the particular key developers that obviously spanned out from today's session there in terms of introducing the Namibia Convention Bureau. Now, we step into our second particular item just before the midway point, but actually before we get to the midway point, we'll be actually heading into a short ad break. After the ad break, we'll come back where we left off and basically, once again, engage where we left off.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any.
While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians.
Smile if you can hear this message. You are blessed. You're alive. You may also realize that Christmas is not about the presents anymore. Christmas is about the gift of love. Your smile is contagious. It is that smile that kept everyone going at ShopRite and Checkers this past year. Thank you for your support. ShopRite Checkers wish you a fabulous festive season.
What's happening? We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relation, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Coming back there from the particular engagement where we left off, or the ad break right there, we step into our next item specifically here on the radar. And as you do know, dear listeners, you're in our company all the way from 1 p.m. or 1 midday to 2:30 p.m. here on your number one talk radio station of Eagle FM. Now, the Ministry of Justice and Labour recently indicated that the next phase of the national minimum wage is set to enter into force, with designated economic groups of the domestic workers, the farm workers and the security guards to be expected at the start of the new year, being that 1 January 2026. Now, all three of these economic groups have gazetted items in the National Gazette that highlights the reforms that have to be met nationally. And this actually also saw the ministry itself going on a particular or introducing a particular campaign in terms of sensitizing the nation at large. However, for this afternoon's session, speaking this afternoon to a representative of the Security Association of Namibia, we speak to the national administrator, that being Celeste Munduru, who indicated that there have been various ups and downs in the sector for the past year so far, and this is as the security guard implementation itself began on 1 January 2025 at the start of this year. For more, let's have a listen to this in-depth discussion. And welcoming to this afternoon session here on the radar, dear listeners. We speak regarding a particular development that has actually been ongoing since last year, 2024, and even before that, specifically regarding discussions around the minimum wage and what has been gazetted so far, which only covers three particular, if we can call them, roles or designations: domestic workers, farm workers, and security guards. For today's particular session, I welcome Celeste Munduru from the Securities Association of Namibia, which is a sectoral representation of the security sector. Celeste, thank you and good morning, or should I rather say good afternoon, because we're actually sort of like recording this before we get onto the program itself.
Thank you for having me, Dwayne, and good afternoon to you and to the listeners as well.
100%. Celeste, if we look at the particular developments, obviously, regarding a national minimum wage, that so far has only cited the three particular sectors or designations, but these, one of them is obviously the sector or the, if we can call it the sector, of the security sector, wherein Sun falls within. Obviously, this has been something that we heard of about in 2024, but at the end of 2025, the Ministry of Labour, in their own scenario, they just, you know, once again cite that the minimum wage has been gazetted and that all stakeholders must play their part in terms of implementation, ensuring that it gets implemented. At the start of 2025, obviously, was the start for the security sector. The first particular question that I've got to ask in that scenario is, what has been the implementation rate or the discussion of, you know, the various particular role players? How did they go about in terms of putting everything in play in order to try and stick to what the Gazette itself had cited?
Well, Dwayne, it has been a very daunting two to three years. The initial consultation started in September 2023, where Sun, together with the Namibia Security Labour Forum, had done a submission with the phase-in proposal, of which that was then implemented in, as you alluded, in August 2024 by the Ministry of Labour then. We then had then to continue with consultations because we were looking at about job losses of around about 10,000 security officers, of which about over 100 SME companies would have closed down. Now, to avoid that catastrophic situation, we then had to do a second submission to the ministry, showing them the effect that it was going to have within the sector. And thus then the review again by the Ministry of Labour, and as such we then managed to get the phase-in proposal of 3 years, which was $13.50 for 2025, $16, which is going to be from the 1st of January next year, and then $18 for the year 2027, 1 January.
Celeste, it's actually a good, it's also good sort of like a jarring my memory discussion, because at the last event specifically that Sun had back in 2024 last year, just before the start of this year, 2025, there was, like you cited, the concern regarding, you know, the ministry having to play a specific role, but that the consultation was not complete. Can I ask the question of, are consultations still ongoing, even as the implementation scenario is ongoing?
It is still ongoing, Dwayne, because remember, we are still struggling with your briefcase companies who are non-members of the Security Association of Namibia, and of which some companies are also not working together with the employee representatives or the different employees representative, which makes it very difficult. So from our side, from Sun, our members have signed a declaration where they have declared that they are being compliant, of which we do have obviously our own investigation mechanism to ensure that our members do comply. We also just in the same light would really be, we are very thankful to the Central Procurement Board who has played a major role in also assisting with the new phase in structure, because you know, the understanding was if you pay your security officer the $13.50, you know, that is it. But then they understood that it's not just the $13.50, but then that there are other statutory obligations and other overhead costs that also needs to factor in on top of that pricing.
Which also follows into the next question that we've also got, the one about, you know, employer-employee relations. You cited a little bit earlier in the introduction, Celeste, about the if the consultations with the ministry did not or were ignored or continued, you know, without said consultations happening, the threat would have been that some smaller security companies would have closed down, and then there would have been sort of like a loss of jobs in that scenario. So the question ultimately about employer and employee relations in the sector after the 1st of January 2025, how has that particular landscape looked in the security sector itself?
Well, Dwayne, you must remember that nearly 70% of the market, or shall I say 80% of the market, are SMEs. And thus the effect is, it has affected them tremendously. And what I would like to also call on companies, and especially SMEs, not to become members of Sun just because they want to have that certificate for tender purposes, but they need to become members because we need to professionalize the industry. Because remember, we are now nearly three decades in the industry, and we are still not regulated. And we actually had the privilege by having Honorable Ipumbo at our private security conference. And, you know, government did confirm that, yes, we need the regulations. So we are currently in consultations with government as well so that we can have this promulgated as soon as possible.
And obviously it's a discussion sort of like that makes it's not one based upon, you know, whether or not there'll be a surety like in next year, but it's obviously one that sights towards the improvement of relations in the landscape entirely. Is it a correct assumption to highlight there?
Yes, it is probably a correct assumption, because remember it's a new administration that currently also took over. So yes, consultations are ongoing. We are continuously following up, and we just hope that hopefully by next year we should be able to get better results, because companies need to be brought to book. Companies need to comply with the statutory laws, and it is not right, because you know it's people's livelihoods that we are playing with here. And it's an industry that we need to have professionalized, and we need to standardize it. And in so doing, we should be able to have a proper regulatory sector.
100%. Celeste, just on the notion specifically of the notion of the implementation so far, is there any data or any statistics of how many of the security companies have so far implemented the staggered minimum wage plan during the course of this year? And obviously, it's still ongoing up until 2027. So what does that landscape look like in terms of the amount of those that could have implemented it?
Well, since the implementation, Sun has, our membership did increase. And as I alluded earlier, we do not want people to join Sun just because they merely just want to have that certificate to be able to get that specific tender.
Mm.
But yes, according to our data collection, we are currently having 495 companies, of which 104
mm.
are picked up members of Sun, of which we know that they are compliant.
Mm.
As I alluded, we don't know how many companies are out there registered with BIPA. It could be 1,000, it could be 2,000, but how do we regulate these companies?
Mm.
So yes, it is an ongoing effort, and we can only do this with robust consultations,
yeah.
And obviously educating the public on it.
Yep. Celeste, has there been any challenges? And then also the opposite, what have been some of the positive developments so far in the security sector with regards to the national minimum wage implementation?
Yes, the main challenge is, as long as we don't have the regulation, there is no way that we're going to be able to regulate the industry. And the mentality that companies are having, and I know I am probably sounding now like a stuck CD, is that we are not just there for tendering purposes.
Mm.
We need to educate the public on the security sector, what the security sector is all about, and we need to inform the public that we need to standardize this, and we ask for the government to really seriously look at the implementation of the regulations, because without the regulations, we basically remain totally useless.
And some of the positives, if there have been positives so far.
There's no positive really with other regulations, but the one thing that I would really say is that we did have on the 22nd our first ever October, our first ever private security conference and as well AGM.
Mm.
It was quite well attended, and we did get some positives, and from that we have realized that we should have or should create such platforms to continue informing the public on what the security sector is all about, and hopefully people will then start complying.
100%. Celeste, on that particular note, if there's still something you wanted to add that I might not have asked, you can still do so before we end our talk.
Firstly, I would like to thank you for having us and giving us this platform to be able to inform the public about what the Security Association is all about, and as well in conjunction with the Namibia Security Labour Forum. And I would just like to inform the public that let us do the right thing. Let us comply. And if there are companies that are still not complying, they are welcome to contact our office. And the Ministry of Justice also recently created a SMS line, number 66111. So if there is any issues of non-compliance, they are welcome to report such companies to that specific number or then our office.
Mm. Now, coming back there from that particular engagement, dear listeners, it's obviously interesting developments, because this scenario of a national minimum wage has been a major talking point around the world, not just in Namibia, primarily as you find more particular developments. I call them developments primarily because they happen in various dimensions in many societies across the world that try to live up with the particular aspects of, firstly, prices and the cost of living scenarios across many countries who are struggling to balance out the earnings that various everyday people earn, as well as also the impacts that much of the prices to live on or to live from. This includes food prices, rental prices, transportation prices, and various other particular aspects impact the pockets and the wallets of many people around the world. Now, this is obviously seen, for example, Namibia also stepping into a national minimum wage dimension. Specifically, just to cite what the ministry themselves, that's now the Ministry of Labor and Justice, or Justice and Labor, had cited a little bit earlier in this month. And this was primarily as they launched their own national minimum wage campaign alongside reading materials associated to this campaign, by stressing that with the support of the International Labour Organization, the ministry has deployed various particular educational aspects to ensure that every Namibian, especially employees and employers, have access to transparent, accurate and reliable information about the national minimum wage. Remember, this is only concentrated so far in the three economic dimensions, which are the three particular economic stakeholders, as mentioned a little bit earlier in the discussion: security guards, farm workers, and domestic workers. Now, this obviously sees that, according to the ministry, they cited that it is important to remember that the minimum wage, or the national minimum wage, was introduced to promote decent work by ensuring that every worker receives fair and lawful compensation. The success of the minimum wage, or the national minimum wage strategy, depends on several factors, one of the most important being information, and that when employees and employers understand their particular rights and responsibilities, compliance improves, disputes are minimized, and social dialogue becomes meaningful. This is according to the ministry itself. Now, on that particular notion, dear listeners, currently where we stand, the ministry themselves cited that currently in the 3-year phase of the introduction of the national minimum wage, the current phase currently stands as, which will kick in from 1 January 2026, is that domestic workers will have to move to the $15 per hour bracket. Agricultural workers will move to the $14 per hour bracket. And the security guards will move to the $16 per hour bracket in that scenario. And on that note, dear listeners, we'll quickly take a short break and we'll come back right after that.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Now, just to say that, dear listeners, we still have the opportunity of, or you still have the opportunity of engaging here on your number one talk radio station, specifically here on the radar, regarding some of the talking points that we've brought up and also mentioned. That is as we are also trying to get into the discussion of getting into our next item, specifically a on-the-air engagement regarding alternative data sources. Now, you can come through at 083-288-401 prior in terms of citing some of the interesting talking points that emanate from there. However, just to refresh from some of the talking points that come through from the last edition of the Villager ePaper platform, as cited or as mentioned a little bit earlier, has been some of the talking points regarding very interesting final reads. I say final reads. They're not actually final because we still have very interesting updates that we provide for you on the website itself. And obviously, if you still have not become a, what do they call that, a subscriber to the ePaper platform, I really don't know where you have been. However, the opportunity is still there for you to engage upon the, or to become a subscriber in that scenario. Just remember, you've got to send us a text message that says subscribe to the number 081-241-44 and save this, you know, for as a WhatsApp, you know, contact. Save the number so that it does not look like we are spamming you with updates every Monday, every Wednesday, and every Friday in that regard. So, just on some of the particular important talking points has been that specifically, like here on Eagle FM, we've stressed the importance of data and the use of data in policy making and in planning, primarily as we've also seen between the discussion of yesterday and the discussions we've had today, specifically here on the On the Radar, where at the heart of everything you can see that data is becoming a focal talking point. Why? Specifically because so much data is being generated on a daily basis and being, well, being collected as well. On an interesting particular note, just to throw there in a particular indication, that's obviously as the use of AI is becoming a little bit more prominent across the world, and primarily how various particular proponents are trying to find ways of applying you know, the use of AI technologies in everyday functions. Now, at the heart of this discussion, before you can even advance to AI itself, you've got to work on a notion in terms of how do you apply data in decision making. How do you also adopt data mechanisms for decision making mechanisms to actually make that those informed decisions that you wish to achieve? One of the most interesting things that we have not seen being clarified in the past 7 years after it came out has been the application of the term or of the data phrase, the 300,000 housing backlog for the affordable housing initiatives across the country. In that particular indication, dear listeners, there was a very important thing that you always have to understand. How many people actually become employed and would have a need for housing? How many of these people are within a particular bracket, an earnings bracket, that can afford the particular housing? How many of these people then have started or begun new households, meaning they married or they moved in with a girlfriend or boyfriend, or they are now having, after becoming married, they now have their first child together, or this is a unit in terms of that has decided to split up and create its own household scenario. Obviously, certain indications come through from the census report and from the labor force survey itself of 2023. The key indications have been obviously how many people are there that began households after becoming employed. A key strategy, a key point to work from. And obviously, there's also the one of the other key indicators, up-to-date employment data sets, which has been something that even the global world itself has also cited. Now, just on that particular talking point has been one in terms of how, the article we've got in the last edition of the e-paper has been based upon central banks and policymakers. But this is more for policymakers because central banks actually work in a specific strategy and in a pretty confined space. The reason why I said it like that is because you even see it in terms of the consensus of economists across the world. They are limited to a specific space, but they give insights from their space, which is banking specifically, into an indication in terms of how this could potentially impact a broader national economy. Basically a macro analysis of what any moves happen in the banking and financial space could impact the broader economic activity to be envisaged in the economy of a country at large. One of them, and this is where I actually have to drop a little bit of a bomb here, one of them actually being the indication of the global AI market. There's a very interesting report. I actually shared it with my colleagues here at Eagle FM just to let them know that potentially, according to the Bank of England, there is another potential financial crash on the horizon. Said particular financial crash could include, actually does include and does revolve around the AI sector. specifically being that the reasons given by the Bank of England is that the insurance risk is becoming higher per month based upon the volumes of money that are being borrowed and that is being distributed between the various companies in the AI development sector. If you don't know what that signals specifically, this is based upon the developments of the likes of Oracle, of Microsoft, of NVIDIA, of OpenAI, as well as also the other affiliate AI programs that are predominantly based in the US, and the amount of money that they are using. Everyone has seen this particular model because most of these companies are registered on stock exchanges, so they have to disclose the information regarding what new developments and activities they are doing, because their shareholders have to know what are the latest developments and how this is going to impact them. This has been shared, this has been analyzed, and this has been assessed in terms of impact towards the global financial markets. So, on such a particular indication, dear listeners, just a quick recap specifically of looking at policymakers and central banks, how they need to visualize and use and make use of data. It's a key particular development that obviously is being assessed and stressed. We stress it in our edition, in our the 15th of December's edition of the Villager ePaper platform, that they've got to look at alternative uses of data as well. Just citing one key talking point being that Namibia's most frequently released data sets include trade stats, inflation figures, and private sector credit extension updates. However, updated data on employment is barely available on a timely basis. And this is the most critical data point in a modern economic discussion. You need to know how many people are resigning, how many people got fired, how many people got retrenched, how many people got employed, how many open vacancies and vacancies there were in the economy, how many of these particular positions are highly skilled positions, how many of these positions are low entry level positions, how many of them are suitable for entry level, meaning positions for someone that just recently finished a diploma or a degree, that or a certification, and they can just quickly be absorbed into that role. And all these particular indications do not exist in the broader Namibian economy. This is not a train smash. I'll cite this to you today. This is not a train smash. This can be achieved. South Africa's Stats SA, which is similar to Namibia Statistics Agency, does this every 3 months, every month. They assess this. Stats SA actually goes above and beyond, and they assess every component of the South African economy and the South African or South Africa as a whole. So you get a comprehensive picture of a statistical analysis and assessment so that you know what it looks like. What is the feature of something like South Africa? Another component or point of data point that is crucial is a data point based upon let's, for example, say population flows, deaths and births. We've got to know how many people are born and how many people pass away at the end of every year. These are key statistical points that are not being counted, not being shared with a broader Namibian space. Another key data point is also the aspect of the impact of crime. What kinds of crime exist, and the release points of these particular crime or the release reports of these kinds of data sets for that matter. I've asked, I've been told in a very kind way, specifically when it comes to crime, that seems to be like a highly sensitive data set to try and release the broader Namibia, but it is an important data set because we need to know as Namibians specifically which sectors are impacted by crimes, which communities are impacted by crimes, and how and what particular strategies potentially could then be directed to which particular policymakers in that scenario. Now, on that note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the 2 p.m. mark of the On the Radar session. We'll be taking a quick break and coming back right after that.
Lipura nengelo wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoewe ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuwana kono ngeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evito danjuka okukwetera oipindi konu konda doinawa nune udo otukwetera o special ange tashake ngejefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge pata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onora esatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kongerewa mura hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
now we come back to listeners there from that quick break right there, and we step into the international news segment here on your number one talk radio station. Now, starting off specifically in South Africa, and this is as the South African presidency has reaffirmed that South Africa's standing with the G20 obviously is still solid. And this is obviously as South Africa is dismissing any suggestion that the country needs an invitation to participate. Now, the spokesperson for the South African presidency, Vincent Magwenya, stressed that South Africa is a founding member of the bloc with an inherent right to take part in all G20 engagements. Now, this is obviously as the United States is trying to sideline South Africa from participating in the next edition of the G20, and this is as Magwenya himself clarified that South Africa has no intention of calling for a boycott of the US-hosted G20 gathering. Now, this comes after Magwenya also confirmed that Pretoria has engaged with other G20 members, urging them to state their position on Washington's stance regarding South Africa's exclusion from certain processes. Let's have a listen to this report.
The G20 dismissing any suggestion that the country needs an invitation to participate. Spokesperson Vincent Magwenya stressed that South Africa is a founding member of the bloc with an inherent right to take part in all G20 engagements. Magwenya went further, warning that the United States is pushing an approach that undermines multilateralism, an agenda he says must be confronted and prevented. He confirmed that Pretoria has engaged other G20 members, urging them to state their position on Washington's stance regarding South Africa's exclusion from certain processes. However, Magwenya clarified that South Africa has no intention of calling for a boycott of the US-hosted G20 gathering.
We have strongly asserted that we don't need to be invited to G20 meetings. We are a full member of the G20. We are a founding member of the G20. Secondly, what the US is seeking to do is an affront to multilateralism, and it must be challenged and it must be rejected by all members of the G20. We've made that point quite clearly. We have been engaging all other members of the G20 on this matter. We have encouraged members to express quite strongly their own views, as they've expressed to us their support as well as their rejection of the US's position and decision in this regard, which was taken unilaterally in a body that takes decision through consensus. What we are not going to do, which is not going to be helpful, we're not going to ask countries to boycott G20 meetings and G20 processes. We were against the US boycott. We will not promote any form of boycott. However, we will continue to advocate for the ongoing championing of the issues that were strongly surfaced during the Johannesburg summit, so that those issues remain firmly on the G20 agenda. Whether the US approves of those issues or not, those are issues that are important not only to us as a country and as a continent, but to the rest of the world. Issues of inequality, issues of how we deal with poverty, climate change, how to ensure climate justice, and so on. Those are issues that cannot be confined to just a single year presidency. Those are issues that need to be taken forward and engaged upon on an ongoing basis. We are also in close discussion with G7 members to ensure that there is a bridge, a continuity bridge substantively of the issues that were surfaced and dealt with at the Johannesburg summit into the G7 agenda as well. And some of those G7 member countries are also G20 member countries. And so that's what we are doing.
Still staying on the African continent specifically and heading to the DRC on this particular notion, dear listeners, it sees the particular developments of M23 withdrawing from the town of Uvira in the eastern DRC. Now, the Rwandan-backed M23 rebel group says it will withdraw from Uvira in the eastern DRC, and the fighters have also seized the city last week. Now, the group says it wants to demonstrate good faith in the ongoing peace process after an appeal from the American mediators. Now, the M23 launched a new offensive earlier this month, despite efforts by Qatar and the US to end the conflict. We have a listen to this particular scenario.
Three rebel groups says that it will withdraw from Uvira in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The fighters seized that city last week. The group says that it wants to demonstrate good faith in the ongoing peace process after an appeal from American mediators. M23 launched a new offensive earlier this month, despite efforts by Qatar and the U.S. to end the conflict. Let's take a closer look at the front lines in Eastern DRC. M23 controls all major urban hubs in that region, as well as the border crossing with Burundi. It seized Bukavu, the provincial capital of South Kivu province, in February. A month earlier, it had captured Goma, the capital of North Kivu. The fighters have also been pushing further south along Lake Tanganyika. And as we mentioned, they took control of the border city of Uvira just a few days ago. Speak to Alan Waikani, who's live for us there in Uvira. So, Alan, M23 say that they're withdrawing. What are you actually seeing on the ground?
Well, nothing up to now. We have seen since this morning just a normal movement of M23 fighters across the town here. We have to mention that the number deployed by M23 in this area was massive. Since we have been in this town here, we have seen them every minute, every moment. You can see the jeep of soldiers, those who are moving by foot. Even this morning, this is the usual movement we have seen here. Nothing has changed up to now. Even from the population, we have been trying to talk to some of them. Others are not even yet informed, and others are just getting the news from the social media. But in reality, on the ground here, nothing so far. But if you have to come on this, the M23, they released this communique just late in the middle of the night, and people, if you try to read right now in different social media here, people are commenting on this, but they know it's all about the pressure, but the reality is there. We have to talk about this reality. M23 is saying very clearly that this is not going to be the handover with the DRC government, because the conflict has been going also between what the fighters are calling defending and protecting their people. That is even the main reason why they said they arrived here in the town of Uvira here, because this area was one of the last strongholds from the DRC government with different allies. We have seen, for example, Burundian, they are just behind the border here, deploying a massive position here, and also the headquarters generals were here coordinating the fighting against the M23, trying to stop their move. But this was not possible. The M23 ended by taking over this town. This is why the fighters are saying it will not be the handover, because they have seen the previous experience with Walikale, where they hand over the area. Normally, the neutral force supposed to be there, but that was not the case. The government ended by taking over the Walikale again. And here, M23 is very clear, neutral force has to come. But if we have to talk about that neutral force, we don't know from where it will come, and this is showing it will be a long process because the majority of the African countries also were part of this conflict. If you have, for example, to take part of SADC, they were defeated by the M23 in Goma alongside the government, and also other forces, the AAC forces, were chased by the DRC government here. So if the mediator will have to find who will be this neutral force, it is going to be a long process, which now people are trying to talk about here in the region.
Alain Waikani reporting from Uvira. Thank you very much, Alain. Let's bring in Paul Simon Handy from the Institute for Security Studies. You're their regional director for East Africa. You're also the Institute's representative to the African Union, and you're in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Thanks for joining us. How do you read this M23's announcement? You know, they just a few days ago, they took Uvira, and now they're saying we're pulling back essentially to give peace a chance, or to give the peace process a chance.
Well, thanks for having me first. And when I hear these statements by the M23, I'm wondering why take the city of Uvira in the first place to say they want to give peace a chance. Wanting to give peace a chance would have meant not taking over Uvira after the signing of the Washington and the Doha agreements. Taking over and now saying we are withdrawing is a tactic we've seen somewhere else by the M23, taking over territories, appearing to withdraw to take them again. This, in my view, is a negotiating tactics by the M23, wanting to create facts and pushing the government of the DRC to make more territorial and economic concessions.
What is their end goal then?
It is a bit difficult to say because they are not openly and officially announcing what their end goal is. Sorry. When you look at the map and when you look at the history of this conflict, because, I mean, we are the M23 is just the modern iteration of a number of rebel groups in that part of the DRC that have made similar grievances and taken over even up to Kinshasa. We will remember that the seizure of Kinshasa by Kabila, the father, was also the outcome after the genocide in Rwanda. It was the outcome of this same campaign. They say officially that they want to liberate their people, which is a bit of a strange rhetoric. But when you look at the map, what I think the M23 and the AFC alliance are doing, they are trying to create some sort of
ekwashilipale kolo marwendo paiwano kupitila mo NHB watupatele komesho kwashilipale kola fika mafio pedola emiliona omlongo da Namibia moshi joshe tukeshe kuyanja omakwafo unamiti enashane filo shisholo paulumo mumbu kwa aboveli ponjeo shilongo shijoshi topo rwasho ijo yetu tashiningwa inapawe banando ishoshe layash opo umone ya kulolo polis mwule omenute dishona elela lishangifako nhp.com.na omanga ino ya morwendo Ponjeo Shilongo. E mangono malandula pano, odo dino kulandurwa. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Buffer zone, which the neighboring countries, particularly Rwanda, but also Uganda, have an interest in controlling. So when you look at the geography of the of North Kivu and South Kivu and the positions of the M23 AFC alliance, the buffer zone rhetoric, two provinces that they will be able to influence, but also to take advantage of in terms of economic return, in which movements of population will also change the demography of the Eastern DRC, seem to be the end goal.
Yeah, Paul Simon, we put up the map as you were describing this, and we do see what you're describing in the sense that they now have a belt of territory that is just along the border with Rwanda that you say could be ultimately a buffer zone. Perhaps that's their goal between Rwanda and DRC. If that is the case, and if that is their end goal, to ultimately control this piece of land next to Rwanda, what purpose do the peace deals serve? The one, there are two. There are the one between DRC and Rwanda, and then the agreement that was signed recently between DRC and M23.
First of all, the buffer zone is not just between the DRC and Rwanda. The buffer zone, as you will see, also goes the North Kivu, the Ituri province that borders Uganda, and now the seizure of Uvira means literally extending the buffer zone in the whole South Kivu province, which and even the capital of Uvira. It's just next door to Bujumbura, the capital of, yep, of Burundi. I struggle to see why the M23, the AFC, and Rwanda will actually, what they will gain in literally aggrieving the U.S. Government, because that's the direct outcome of this military offensive, and I'm quite sure that the announcement by the M23 to move out of Uvira is probably also a direct consequence of the reaction, the very strong reaction that the U.S. government showed both in the U.N. Security Council in some public statements. So I struggle to see the strategic objective they are trying to gain by aggrieving the main backer of the peace agreements. Should the seizure of Uvira remain, it will be a blow for the U.S., for the U.S. president. It will be a blow for current negotiations in Qatar and in the U.S., but it will put enormous pressure also both to President Tshisekedi internally, but also internationally to President Kagame.
As we head over from the African context into an international peace negotiation process, this is obviously as the developments still coming through from the engagement that is taking place in Berlin, wherein there is a possibility or a green light, or even a light at the end of the tunnel, specifically regarding the Ukraine-Russia conflict, is that Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, says that peace talks with the U.S. negotiators have been productive, but have not been easy, as he was speaking following talks in Berlin aimed at reaching a peace deal to end the war in Ukraine. Now, Zelensky said he wants clear security guarantees for his country from the U.S. and Europe before he will consider making a territorial concessions to Russia. Now, he has been under heavy pressure from the Trump administration to cede territory to Russia in the exchange for peace. Let's have a listen to this engagement.
Zelensky says peace talks with U.S. negotiators have been productive, but not easy. He was speaking following talks in Berlin aimed at reaching a peace deal to end the war in Ukraine. Zelensky said he wants clear security guarantees for his country from the U.S. and Europe before he will consider making territorial concessions to Russia. He has been under heavy pressure from the Trump administration to cede territory to Russia in exchange for peace.
A reception with the German president, talks with the German chancellor, an appearance before business leaders and dinner with European allies. Volodymyr Zelensky spent 2 days in Berlin engaging in intensive talks aimed at ending Russia's war on Ukraine. However, the most important meetings took place almost entirely behind closed doors, those with U.S. negotiators Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. The president of Ukraine said afterwards, the meetings were not easy but productive. Witkoff indicated that they made a lot of progress in the talks but did not elaborate. A U.S. official said it's now up to Ukraine to decide what territories in the Donbas region might be given to Russia. President Zelensky reiterated he cannot relinquish territories in eastern Ukraine permanently, which are currently occupied by Russia. but he has conceded on NATO membership for Ukraine, tentatively accepting new security guarantees instead.
We have heard from the U.S. that there will be security guarantees that are similar to NATO's collective defense pledge, Article 5, and that is a first step. Then the question of monitoring a ceasefire. I would say this is the very foundation of security guarantees.
The German Chancellor appealed to the Russian leadership to stop attacks on Ukraine and to accept the common peace plan drafted by the US, the Europeans and Ukraine.
Perhaps the Russian leadership still has a shred of human decency left and will at least leave the population in peace for a few days over Christmas. And perhaps that could then be the beginning of reasonable constructive talks on how we can achieve lasting peace in Ukraine.
After talks in Berlin, the German government is looking to US negotiators to convince Russia's leader Vladimir Putin to accept the peace plan. A U.S. official in Berlin said 90% of the issues between Russia and Ukraine have been resolved now, but a date for the next meeting with the Russians has not yet been set.
Simon Young joins us now from in front of the Chancellery. He has been following the talks today and yesterday. Of course, Simon, European leaders are attending right now a meeting and proposing a European-led multinational force, Ukraine. What is that? What more can you tell us about this proposal that's on the table?
Yeah, Nicole, this is part of a statement that European leaders who've been meeting at the Chancellery here in Berlin behind me have released this evening. And it talks about a wide range of support measures for Ukraine now and going forward during a ceasefire and in the reconstruction process. And I think the chief point is the one you've already mentioned, this multinational force Ukraine made up of countries in the framework of the Coalition of the Willing. That's European nations primarily that have been supporting Ukraine. And it also says backed by the United States. And the role of that will be both to assist in the training regeneration of the Ukrainian Defense Forces, but also to help them in securing their airspace and also their maritime coast. As part of that, it says that U.S. support should continue, particularly to help the Ukrainians in surveillance of their airspace and of their territory, monitoring any ceasefire. So this is going to be absolutely key. The document also talks about Ukraine continuing to maintain a peacetime defense force level of 800,000 troops. And it also goes on to say that the ball is really now in Moscow's court. It's up to them to accept this peace plan, a plan that I believe European leaders are presenting this as a common peace plan supported by Ukraine, by the Europeans, but also by the United States. So something like a breakthrough this evening here in Berlin.
It sounds sensible, but does it get even close to the Article 5-like security guarantees that Ukraine has been asking for? Do we know how it's going to work in practice?
Well, like I said, I think it's talking about supporting Ukraine's military, but also in terms of keeping its own strength up to readiness. But they're also talking clearly about putting European forces on Ukrainian territory, but exactly what form that will take, how many of them that will be, is not clear. If they're really only there to, as it were, do training and assist, then that might not be so many of them. And of course, this is going to be a key point of dissension with Moscow, which has said that it wants to see a sort of almost demilitarized Ukraine going forward. So it's not a security guarantee in that sense, but at least if they're saying that the United States are on board monitoring a ceasefire, guaranteeing it, and willing to intervene in some form, the details, of course, have yet to be worked out, then that comes some way, it goes some way at least, to providing those all-important security guarantees for the Ukrainians.
You said it's set to happen in the framework of the so-called coalition of the willing. Do we know what countries would take part in it? Is it likely that all EU countries will agree to this? And we're, of course, looking at the usual suspect Hungary there.
Well, I think those again are among the details to be worked out. I don't suppose it is relevant that all EU countries would be involved, but clearly this is something that's got the backing also of NATO. This idea of a multinational force, it's not the first time it's been mentioned, but I think it's the first time it's been given this prominence in one of these documents that the international leadership have been working on for months and indeed years to try and find a way forward to peace in Ukraine. Now they're talking about this idea more clearly. They also say that they'll continue to work intensively over the coming days. We've got a European summit coming up later this week, but of course it's going to take a bit longer than that, I'm sure, to put all the details around this idea into position.
CW Simon Young in Berlin. Thanks so much, Simon.
Well, to shed more light on this, let's bring in John Hardy, Russia Programme Deputy Director at the Foundation for the Defence of Democracies. He joins us from Atlanta in the US. John, thank you so much for joining us here on DW. Basically, all of the participants of today's talk speak of real or significant progress being made. What's your assessment?
Well, thanks for having me. It does sound like there was significant, the Ukrainians see significant progress in the kind of aspect of the discussion focused on security guarantees. That seems to be where they're most happy with what President Trump and his envoys have on offer. The issue of territory, though, I think is probably the biggest sticking point, with Witkoff and Kushner kind of pushing the Ukrainians to agree to Russia's demand to withdraw from the rest of the Donbass. That's something that Putin says his forces will do by force if the Ukrainians don't agree. Although in my view, there's really very little prospect the Russians can achieve that, and therefore the Ukrainians don't see much reason to oblige.
And what specifically stood out to you there, especially on the topic of U.S. security guarantees?
Well, if you look at previous drafts of what the U.S. has on offer and kind of some of the signals coming out of Berlin, it sounds like what's on offer is significantly more than Ukraine has ever received from the United States. Not quite as good as membership in NATO, but it's not nothing. That being said, I do worry that the Trump administration might be getting out a little bit over its skis. Some of the language is really Article 5-like, where there's not an explicit commitment to intervene militarily in Ukraine, but kind of language along those lines. And really, the recent presidents on a bipartisan basis haven't been willing to do that. I don't think there's any consensus in Congress about a willingness to do that. And so I just worry that we're kind of offering something that's hollow, and if tested, would not respond accordingly, which could lead to kind of undermine credibility in the actual Article 5 for NATO.
And with that specifically in mind, then, what do you think is your assessment of what made the progress actually possible? I mean, did the U.S. actually listen to the Europeans then, or did the Europeans maybe bow to U.S. pressure?
I think the Trump administration has been generally receptive to the fact that Ukraine wants some sort of security guarantee to enable it to do a peace deal. I think everyone understands that we don't want to have a third war. And unfortunately, I think that however this war ends, if it does end in negotiated settlement, it's unlikely to kind of fundamentally resolve the basic struggle between Russia and Ukraine over Ukraine's future and sovereignty. So the chances of a third war, unfortunately, are high. So the need for a security guarantee is obvious. I think that the Ukrainians have been explaining to Witkoff and Kushner that if they are going to show any sort of flexibility on territory, that there's going to have to be kind of that firm guarantee to give them the flexibility and confidence to do that and to be able to sell it to the Ukrainian people.
And on that note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end for this afternoon session of the On the Radar. This Things are almost getting halfway through this particular week. Obviously, this is still Tuesday. We'll see each other again same time, same place tomorrow. Stay tuned for the rest of your programming to follow on after the break.